Hey everyone, it's the Kung Fu Genius, aka Alex Richter, and I just want to let you know that if you're a Wing Chun practitioner, especially from the WT or Leung Ting line, and you want to get really personalized intensive private training with me, you can now apply to do an immersion course with me here in NYC, or if you like the sun, in my Florida home near Orlando. These courses are for instructors or anyone who's serious about learning the art in detail and working hard. I teach in program blocks like Siunam Tao, Chum Kyu, Biu Chi, and Wooden Dummy, and those include the Chi Sao Theory, fighting applications, and training methods as well. If you're really serious about learning Wing Chun, check out the link in the description below to find out about applying for a spot. And while you're here, don't forget to subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius on YouTube, like this video, and share it on your social media platforms. And with that, let's get started.
All right, peeps. On today's episode of the Kung Fu Genius, the genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of philosophical nonsense, lots of Elvis putting hits out on your ass. Let's get to it.
He is unstoppable, unbeatable, unbelievable. He's Alex Richter, the Kung Fu Genius.
And every day, I practice martial arts. Watch
out. Word is, I'm a Kung Fu Genius.
Yo, Dre, how you doing, man?
What's up, Sifu?
Doing good, huh?
I'm good, right?
Yeah. You know, I think people, it's difficult for people to understand the timeline of our podcast because by the, you know, we shoot these like a few weeks in advance and then they come out. So
we're about 2 months in advance.
Yeah, now because I have kind of a heavy traveling schedule through December. I got to go down to Florida, teach some students down there in the new place for the immersion course. Mm-hmm. So we're packing in every week. We're recording like 2 to 4 episodes, yes, depending on the week. So we're like way in advance. So I think sometimes like when people see this, by the time it comes out, one, it's really old for us. But also when this was shot, yeah, which is today, we just finally saw the Beardy episode for the first time. The Beardy episode had not yet come out at the time of this recording.
Yes,
but
right,
we have actually seen some clips of it, and I'm super excited. So the great thing about talking about that now, mm-hmm, is that by the time this video comes out, that's super old.
We've forgotten most of it.
Yes.
So it's new for us too.
Yeah, because we shoot them so in advance. Yeah. We send them to, you know, Andrew, our editor, who just does a great job. You know,
seriously, the sick job.
Andrew's killing it, right?
Oh man!
And it makes
I love
me kind of
bat thing, the yeah, Batman thing he does.
Well, it makes me kind of jealous because people are like, "Yo, your editing is like so good all of a sudden, right?"
All of a
and
sudden,
and I'm like, because I edited the episodes before Andrew took over. I'm like, my editing wasn't that bad, right? But no, I have to admit, when I watched the new episodes that Andrew's edited, they're just, I mean, this isn't like a very complicated podcast, it's just you and me, and you know, but the way that you
sat
kind of
right here, by the way,
yeah, whatever, no one pays any attention to that dude. And so we have
Deuce's getting no love.
Yeah, we got Igor in the corner there, right?
Any sitcom, any like
bloody
producers
hell
get zero.
I had a mouthful
love
of coffee when you said that.
Igor. Is it Igor? No, it's Igor, right? Never mind Igor back over there. But Andrew does a really good job. He was absolutely killing it. So the Beardy episode was a little complicated because we shot like our normal podcast format, but then we also did like a reaction video to his videos. And like I sent them the reaction video, which is the two of us, which by the way, is the proof that we're in the same studio
we
for all the
have proven it.
Yeah, for all the conspiracy
kinda
theorists. Yeah, I'm sure they're going to be like, no,
no,
you can
split
see there's
screen
a line in the middle that's still not there, whatever, right?
Bruce Lee script.
Yeah,
down the middle.
Years after we're gone, it's going to come out that we've actually never met. Or that you, Dre, are just a computer simulation, yeah, and you don't even
right
exist,
are
right?
Are you kidding me? I'm writing it in my memoir.
So, you know, I sent Andrew, like, when we send him all the stuff for the episodes, I'm like, all right, this is one episode about Beardy, this fake, you know, Bruce Lee YouTube channel. But we have, like, you got to splice in these reaction clips. I don't know how to do it. I had kind of an idea in my mind if I were editing it, but, like, I was worried, like, I'd have to give him a lot of notes.
Yeah.
And I sent everything to him, and he did an awesome job. Mm. He did it exactly the way I would have wanted to do it, but better, you know? So really kicks ass, man.
Surpassed.
So anyway, so just to give people
surpassed
some context, weeks and weeks and weeks ago, we had the Birdie episode.
Right.
And that's at the time of this recording,
itching for it to come out.
And the time of this recording, it still hasn't happened yet. So I can imagine there's going to be some reaction to that one. So anyway, we're doing another AMA. Mm-hmm. And so let's get to it.
All right. First out the gate, we got CK. Okay. What do you think is the current state of material arts? Do you think that the non-physical part of it is often left out or not taught enough? Material arts is...
martial arts. He spelt it wrong.
Okay.
All right?
All right. Because
okay. Martial arts often...
I know what material arts... That's from Madonna's
Material
thing.
Girl.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
She was the queen of material arts.
Absolutely.
I'm just amused that we do a Kung Fu podcast and it didn't occur to you that that might have been a typo.
Yeah, I know. Exactly. Of all the typos we get, all right?
But the thing is, I read it as I, you know...
No. It's Dre style. It's like, No.
I just read it.
Clearly, that's what he meant. Material arts. That's kind of strange.
He definitely meant...
Probably meant martial arts, right?
Okay. Because
it is. But maybe he did it as a pun, like the way martial arts have become very materialistic or very commercial. Maybe he meant to do it on purpose, right?
That's deep.
Yeah, except that's not what you were thinking. You're literally like, material arts, I don't get it.
Maybe all this time it was actually martial girl and not material girl.
That's right, it could have been martial girl. Just Madonna said it wrong, right?
Yeah.
And it reminds me because oftentimes the word...
In a martial world. Marshall.
We should do that as a spoof.
Marshall.
Yeah, like Weird Al Yankovic take the KFG does classic pop songs, but makes them all kung fu or martial arts themed, right?
Kung fu-y.
Yeah, it's interesting. Martial is often misspelled in many, like when people want to write martial arts, because sometimes even if you don't use the word martial very often, your phone will normally correct it to marital.
I've seen that a lot.
Yeah, so you see marital arts all the time.
And marital arts!
Which reminds me, I think years ago...
Oh, it's even better!
When I was a teenager, my mom read People magazine, right? And so, I would like grab it, and they had an article on Van Damme in there.
I remember
at the
supermarket.
Yeah, Van Damme had just gotten divorced. And I remember normally I wouldn't read People magazine as a teenager, but there's something about Van Damme in there, so I'm going to read it. And I think the title of the article was No Master of the Marital Arts. So for some reason, it was like some silly thing I read as a teenager. Oh, and every time I see martial arts misspelled as marital arts, I always think of Van Damme.
Yes.
Like this Van Damme
Van
pops
Damme
in my mind.
Connection.
So I have to admit, I totally forgot the question.
What do you think is the current state of martial arts? And do you think that the non-physical part of it is often left out or not taught enough?
Are you sure that's not marital arts after all?
That's right.
It's definitely marital.
So basically the idea of
non-physical parts of marital arts.
So basically the kind of the deeper benefits of martial arts training, are those things still being pushed or propagated in modern martial arts training, or is it just the fighting and kicking and punching or something like that? It's basically how I understood that.
That's
right?
The best part.
Well, of course, this is the problem, okay? This is where we have to kind of balance what real good hobbies can give a human being that are beyond the realm of that particular hobby. And like the bullshit of the, it's not about fighting. It's just about being one with the Tao. Okay, well, you are also doing martial arts, and the presumption is that if somebody tries to take a swing at you, you can actually stop them or protect yourself. And you're not going to go it's not about fighting. you're knocked out. Sorry. All right. So what is your philosophy going to do in that moment, right? So we've grown up with this stuff. You have kind of the extreme versions of what people think of like the Mr. Miyagi style of training.
Well, that's why I love David Carradine's character in Kung Fu so much.
I'm
going to
kill you. All right, you stop right now. You stop right now with that
nonsense.
He was
about that life.
Not really. He got fired from the Kung Fu TV show because he was high on peyote and running down his block naked. So that was David Carradine then, all right?
And let me talking about the character.
Yeah.
Kung Fu character.
Yeah, but see, none of that stuff transferred or transcended into his real life. And let's also not forget that he died in a masturbation accident, all right? So definitely Hashtag fail on that, okay? So anyway, for people who wonder why I harsh on David Carradine, you can go back a few episodes. I did an episode on my, in one of the AMAs, I talked about my meeting with David Carradine. And so let's just say he was not awesome, okay?
I wish I was there for that.
Yeah, no, my story makes it sound better than it was actually way worse than that. It was just super uncomfortable and awkward.
Song was great though. Yeah.
When we look at martial arts as like the palette of what martial arts can give a human being. Okay. So we say, okay, obviously there's a fighting or self-defense component. Some schools separate the two, maybe fighting something more about competitive between two different martial arts practitioners, self-defense being when someone assaults you. And, you know, some schools, for them, that's like one category. Fighting and self-defense is no different. And for other schools, those two categories are separate. And for other schools, they only do one or the other, right? And, you know, sometimes people feel like it's easy to get caught up in all of these kind of dichotomies, and that really doesn't exist. If someone takes a swing at you, you can either defend yourself or you can't. But there's a huge mental difference between fighting and self-defense. And the difference is, in fighting, you have two willing participants. And in self-defense, you only have one. And that changes the dynamics of the entire interaction, right? Now, I'm not the guy who says, you know, look, in a real street fight, like some Wing Chun and JKD people, like, in a real straight, I go, BUG, the guy right in the eyes, and kick him in the balls, and that'll stop anyone from attacking me. I'm like, no, I don't really think so. I think you believe it will, but I don't really think you have the practice to actually do that. And it's one thing in class if you crack your partner in the eyes in class that you're training with. It's another thing when some dude who outweighs you by 100 pounds starts storming at you on the street, and it's not going to happen the same way. Yeah. So I'm not the guy who teaches the, like,
getting him in the cheek.
Yeah, but I'm not the guy that says, like, yeah, in the street there are no rules, and I can kick you in the nuts and jab you in the eyes and do all this stuff, because in sport martial arts, like MMA, you're not allowed to do all these things. Da, da, da. Yeah, but if you fight an MMA guy in the street, he can also do all that stuff to you too. And I'm putting my money on the MMA guy gouging your eyes out over you gouging the MMA guy's eyes out, right? So I'm a traditional martial arts guy. I'm a Wing Chun guy, but I'm not that guy, all right? And we have a lot of those guys in Wing Chun and Jeet Kune Do. I'm like, you're as good as you've practiced and no better. You don't rise to the occasion when you're attacked. You sink to the level of your training, all right? And if you understand that, that gives you a fair assessment of kind of where you're at, right?
That's where it's at.
So anyway, so that's the fighting and self-defense aspect, right? That is, for many people who do martial arts, that is top of mind, whether you want to be a competitive kickboxer, Brazilian jiu-jitsu grappler, or MMA fighter or karate fighter, or you want to learn, okay, if someone grabs me or tries to throw me down or tries to put me in a hold, how do I deal with it? All right. So that's the kind of, you know, wheels on the ground. What does your martial art actually do? And that is very important, because people come to martial arts to solve those problems of violence, whether they're actually going to need it or not. So we can't say, in martial arts, it's all about the philosophy and it's all about this kind of stuff. Dude, take up painting then, okay? Or literally take up philosophy, all right?
Yeah.
But don't tell me that an art form that teaches you how to smash your fist in someone's face or how to crank someone's arm behind their shoulder, like in jiu-jitsu, right? Or to kick someone in the knee is solely designed for you to become one with the Tao. Okay? Because then I start to go, no, what's happening is you're starting to see that the problems of violence are kind of complicated. They're multifactorial. They're not as solved in such simple tropes as Mr. Miyagi might make them seem to be.
Right.
So rather than going like, well, we need to solve this. If we want to really learn how to defend ourselves, we need to honestly address what happens if you're on the ground, what happens if weapons are involved, what happens if there's more than one person, what happens if this person is not fighting within the way you fight in your style. Those are things we need to do. And rather than try to answer those very difficult and hard questions, people go, yeah, but it's not about that. It's about becoming one with your environment and one with your opponent and all this kind of stuff. And here's the thing. All of those things are aspects that any good martial arts system can give you. But to say that the primary driver of martial arts is solely to find inner harmony at first, I feel is a way to skate the question of not wanting to solve the riddle of violence. Having said that, not everyone comes to martial arts for the same reason. So that's the other reason why it's easy for people to disagree with what I literally just said and still, and they would be correct. Mm-hmm. Because some people who have a lot of fire in their body, you know, they're like naturally hot-tempered, they might not come to martial arts to learn how to fight. They might actually come to martial arts to channel that anger somewhere, right? Yeah. So for that person, now that person is using martial arts as a vehicle to go on a different journey than the person who's worried about getting mugged.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? The person who is like the proverbial 90-pound weakling afraid of their shadow, they need to come to martial arts to maybe open up and get out of their shell a little bit. And that journey is far more important than they're not really worried about getting attacked.
Mm-hmm.
They just maybe need the confidence to ask their boss for a raise. And going to the gym isn't giving them that. So going to a martial arts school can make them feel a little bit more empowered. So all of these other aspects that you can gain from martial arts are 100% real and 100% achievable. And they're often the goals of many people who are not specifically looking for fighting.
Yeah.
But that is how martial arts can become an overall vehicle for you to self-actualize.
Mm-hmm.
But to say then that jujitsu or Wing Chun or boxing or kickboxing was designed originally so you could self-actualize is, I believe, not historically accurate, nor is it true. You can become very philosophical and find philosophy, all right? And it's a very generic way of saying a living philosophy, a way to harmonize, learn about the relationships between people and how people interact with each other. You can get these lessons through gardening. You know, because when, you know, the gardener goes out there
nature.
And you have to, you reap what you sow and you have mm-hmm. to, you have to take care of this plant so that it'll grow and nurture it the same way you nurture a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And why does it not always grow that way? Because there's problems, there's conflict, there's things that need to be solved. And you can find all of the problems of human existence. You can learn this through gardening.
Mm-hmm.
You can learn all of this through dance,
mm-hmm.
dealing with your own ego and improving and the problem. You can find how human beings interact and the problems with interaction in any pursuit you decide to really go in. That's why people at a very high level of any profession or pursuit, I mean really, really high level, often at some point become very philosophical. Because when they kind of transcend that field and look at it as a vehicle, like even high-level lawyers, like a doctor of law, at some point they kind of transcend it and they look at this as solving the problems of human interactions when they go wrong
mm-hmm.
and why we need laws and not and how these things are broken, they can still achieve that through there. So martial arts is not unique in that aim. You can find your peace through martial arts. You can find it through gardening. You can find it through gymnastics. You can find it through car racing. Okay? Because the moment you internalize any pursuit, all the principles are the same and to get become excellent at something. So all of those things are real. But I find as long as you're not a silk pajama wearing kung fu guy, that the moment someone says like, yeah, well, what if someone comes in with double leg takedown and then tries to pin you and do all this stuff? You go, no. It's all about harmonizing. When that becomes your answer, when someone is asking you a question of violence, then I go, you're avoiding it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually not a very positive way of dealing with things that you don't like, to kind of avoid the argument entirely by saying, no, it's not about the fighting. It's not about the aggression. It's not, but it also is. Okay? And if you don't want to address those things, okay, then you can say, I do martial arts solely to gain confidence. I do martial arts solely to calm myself down a little bit. Or I do it because it's a worthwhile pursuit or it's a great way to get exercise without just doing mind-numbing reps at the gym. But you don't go, when someone asks you, how do you stop someone from, you know, taking a swing at your head? Oh, no, it's not about that. It's about this. Then I go, you're moving the chest. You're playing tennis without a net.
Yeah.
All right. There's no stake in there when you do that. And so that's why many martial arts schools, I still think you can find those things. The way I do it at City Wing Chun is when people first come to me, I don't inundate them with a bunch of philosophical bullshit. And here in Wing Chun, it's all just, it's all just about harmonizing with the Tao and all that kind of stuff. No, people come to me, they go, someone is trying to punch me in the face. How do I keep from getting punched in the face? My job is to help them solve that problem. All right. How to become more confident, how to go in, how to close the gap, how to learn some new skills and a new way of interacting. When you start advancing in Wing Chun, you're going to hit a wall if you don't start internalizing certain ideas about how to kind of blend with your partner and how to borrow power and how to calm yourself down. And when the fight is getting too chaotic, you have to clinch and slow it down. And when the guy's trying to grab you, you maybe need to speed it up, and how you have to have this kind of very yin-yang interaction. And through the example of martial arts, you can apply this to your daily relationships with people. Not that you punch someone when they disagree with you, but like learning how, when to go forward, when to yield, when to give way, when one strategy isn't working, how you adapt it and then go forward using something else, right? These are all things that are applicable to your life, but I feel they're most applicable to your life if you know how to apply them in actual fighting and sparring.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of the scores of people who just give lip service to these kind of things, but they don't really live it and they can't really do it, then I find it's actually empty.
Mm.
So I'm all for this kind of deeper philosophical stuff through martial arts, as long as it comes from a real and genuine place and it's not just, the yoga bros telling you about, I'm going to give you a hug and we're going to align our heart chakras, because that's why yoga was created.
Wow.
All right. All right. Next one.
Deep. All right. Yo, that was philosophical right there.
That was BS. I was just talking out of my ass most of the time.
I love it. All right, next up, we got Dorian Farad. Okay. As a Wing Chun practitioner, it's a how do you maintain skill or progress when you are without training partners at your level, or even training partners at all due to COVID. Wait, we gotta reread this. All right.
Since when are we speaking French? You're the one reading the questions here.
We.
He's the one picking them as
well. Yeah, you pick the question. You're like, oh, well, wait a minute. All right.
The question is, how do you maintain? Because it's... how do you maintain skill or progress when you are without training partners at your level, or even training partners at all due to COVID?
Now that makes more sense.
Yeah. Yes. All right. What ways can you supplement solo training to maintain an advanced skill when a partner isn't available? How do you think the Wing Chun ancestors did so, when often they had to train in secret by themselves or only had lesser skilled disciples to practice with?
That's a good question. It's a multi-part question. All right. So first of all, I don't know how much our ancestors were lacking training partners or people to train with. No, I wasn't there. So you have to be very careful. You can't look at the Wing Chun family tree of, Yim Wing Chun, Leung Bok Chow, Leung Lang Kwai, Wong Wa Bo, Leung Yi Tai, Leung Chan, and then, Chan Ma Sun, and go like, so each of these people here just had one person that they trained with or whatever, right? You can't, huh? I just made up.
Boom, bam, boom.
I just made up all those things.
No, you did not.
No.
No, you did not.
I'm reading over there. That's a list of all the people who owe us money, all right? So those are not Wing Chun practitioners. It's guys in Chinatown who owe us money. So, so of course, then you can make the assumption all these people didn't have a lot of people to train with, or Wing Chun was a secret style or whatever. But don't make that assumption, because the thing is, we don't actually know about the nature of the, forebearers of Wing Chun and how and when they trained and with whom and with how many people or whatever. So the gist of his question I really like, but I always like to just plant the flag where we go, be careful of those little mini assumptions you make about how people trained or what the nature of their training was, or whether they were alone or in secret. Because the fact that a style was secret doesn't mean that it was only one person doing it. Right?
I keep seeing that. Right?
Yeah. It's the sound of one hand clapping is not the history of Wing Chun. Okay, so So one, you need to be mindful of that, right? The last part there too is like, how do you train when you have less skilled disciples? And that is actually something that was an issue for me when I started teaching Wing Chun here in New York, because when I went to Germany to do Wing Chun full time, I was training, you know, at the castle at Langenzell for 3 years. I trained 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I had training partners outside of the regular daily training. So it was just like eating non-stop. And sleeping nonstop Wing Chun, right? That was literally all we did.
You were
we
the nothing. Beardy.
Hey, 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 hey.
Hey, 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 hey.
Of training. Don't call me. Of training.
What does that mean? I made fake videos about training? What are you talking about? No.
You trained as much as Beardy.
No, I trained as much as Beardy thought he was training in his mind, all right? So, So I went from having all sorts of training partners at my disposal during the 6 hours a day. We had the regular training partners there, plus all the visitors who would come in that day. Afterwards, I had my Norwegian training partners, my other German training partners, and Turkish training partners, and we would train and assimilate the information we got. So literally, we was doing nothing but Wing Chun.
So crazy.
And then I go from that, and then I start teaching, and now it's just me. So I was a primary level technician, so kind of a junior instructor. And I opened my school in New York. And now it's like, okay, well, now I don't have anyone high level to train with, right? But I'll tell you something interesting. That time that I left after training at the castle and I started to teach, and for the first few years, I didn't obviously have any high level students because I now have to teach people from the beginning. Mm-hmm. That period represent the greatest growth I had as a martial artist. And I think that like in terms of the rate of growth, all right? And I think people, they don't understand that because they go like, all right, in Wing Chun, let's say you learn Siu Nam Tao Cham Kyu, and then you learn the Biu Ji, and you have to learn how to use the Biu Ji and the Qi Sao and the fighting, and then you learn the wooden dummy and how to use the wooden dummy and Qi Sao and fighting, and then the pole and the knives, and then they go, oh, and now you have no one to train that stuff with. So what are you going to do? Oh, you only have low-level students. Well, guess what? No martial art functions without world-class basics. I don't care how cool or authentic your long pole is. If your basics, pakta, stepping in, closing the gap, using pinning punches, fist to defend fist, you know, getting in on someone who's trying to strike you, if you cannot do that at a really, really high level, I don't give a shit how authentic your long pole is. I don't give a shit how many movements on the wooden dummy you can do or whether you know the wooden dummy Qi Sao section 7 or 8. Because that is not going to stop you. When someone takes a swing, the thing that's going to protect you when someone takes a swing is your solid understanding and execution of the fundamentals. And guess what? That's exactly what you teach the beginners.
Yeah.
So you learn all this stuff, you practice all this stuff, and now you have not the opportunity, you have the privilege to go through all of your basics with a fine-tooth comb, because now you have to explain it and demonstrate it and show it to the next generation. So what do? Now you're teaching students, okay, if someone takes a, you know, throws a punch at you, you got pop, 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 you got to do this. Okay, go ahead, throw a punch at me, da, 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 da. And then you show them, which means you cannot just like say how it's done. You got to show them.
You got to show them.
And now you're training with them. And what are you doing? You're reinforcing how to defend straight punches, low punches, swings, tackles, kicks, all this stuff. Because guess what? That's the stuff that you get attacked with on the street. And everyone goes, you don't have anyone to train Buji with. So what? All right? If you ask me if I would rather have a training partner that knew all this like Wing Chun stuff, or I would rather just have a training partner that I could do some sparring with and maybe didn't know that much Wing Chun, I would always take the person I could do some sparring with. Because that's how you practice. I don't need my partner to do Wing Chun to make my Wing Chun look or feel better. I better he doesn't know that much Wing Chun, all right? Keeps things real and keeps things fresh. So there's this mistake, this fallacy in one's head that the only way you continue to get good at Wing Chun at the advanced levels is by having other advanced people to train with, all right? Your beginner student that is not highly skilled in Wing Chun, you could still train them to throw jab, cross, uppercut, swing, and try to take your head off or give you a kick. And you do the same thing for them and you get better at those things. Now, guess what? You're not doing high level wooden dummy chiso. You're doing single arm chiso. But guess what? If your single arm chiso sucks, I don't care about your wooden dummy. Mm. I don't care about your advanced chiso. Show someone, show a beginner how to do single arm chiso and do it well and show them and let them feel what it's like in the positions and the reactions and the movement and the stance and how you turn and when you move. That's how you get really good. And later in Wing Chun, we have something called instructor-led sparring or instructor-led chiso sparring. When the students learn the basics in chiso and you're basically playing the attacker, there are lots of protocols in there for instructors where you could slip in some of your advanced stuff, but you're doing it not just to beat up a student that doesn't know the advanced stuff. You're actually doing it in the moment you need it. So what do? You encourage your student to become more and more skillful. All right, give me a paxo. Boom. No, really here. Bam. Okay, I want you to really slap my arm. Keep your hand relaxed. Imagine you're trying to kill a mosquito or a fly on my arm. Bam. And then what I'm doing is I'm encouraging my student to go harder, faster, and do things with better technique and form. So I'm literally building my training partner right there in live time. Don't just give me a half-assed paxo and then I can show you how I can beat it. I want your paxo to be epic. Come on, boom. So what you're doing, you're playing the trainer and they get better and better and better and you make them better and better. And then once they start giving you solid attacks, now you have to defend it. But now I can work my defense, but I'm working my defense against a way more solid attacker because I am building this person not to be my training dummy. I'm building this person to be my training partner. Mm-hmm. So I'm constantly building training partners and I train all the time with students who are not at my level in Wing Chun, but I'm building them in such a way where they're also giving me things that I can pay attention to. Mm. All right. So there's that whole thing. Now, if you don't have a training partner, obviously you have to go the more solo route. Any skill you can develop, whether it's chiso or fighting or footwork or whatever, always begins as an idea in the mind, all right? You cannot develop the skill of a punch, of a paxo, of a kick, of a defense against a certain movement without first having the idea in your mind. So all skills in martial arts that you possess or want to possess begin as a thought in the mind. This does not require you to have a training partner. So you have your idea and you start training this as a solo exercise. Now, it's obviously not the same as if someone is actually coming at you with punches and resisting and all that kind of stuff. But if you don't have a partner, you got to do with what you got. Mm-hmm. All right. So there's obviously lots of solo training you can do from a technical standpoint. Your movements and techniques, you can polish them in the air so you make them really clean. Not the same as doing it with a partner, but better than doing nothing. Mm. But what else can you do when you don't really have a partner? You can improve attributes, all right? Speed, power, conditioning. You can improve the athleticism of your martial arts. All the stuff you can do without a partner, heavy bag, wall bag, footwork, conditioning, rounds, all this kind of, so many things you can do that doesn't require a partner. Shadow boxing in Wing Chun. Good footwork, movement, and reactions. And what I like to do is, especially at the beginning of COVID, when you didn't have like a partner, we have YouTube. YouTube is a tremendous resource, and not for just for watching instructional videos to learn something new, but for learning reactions, okay? Yeah. Watch a video of your favorite fighter, whether it's boxing or kickboxing or MMA or whatever, and you put it on your TV, or just pick one fighter in the exchange. Stand in your position, and every time that person throws a punch or a kick, do what you would technically do against it, all right? And so that means that you can now practice against Anderson Silva, all right? You stand there. Now, mind you, it's not perfect because sometimes when you're watching a fight, it's in profile. It's not coming to you. But you can stand there and you watch Anderson and you can move around. And when he fires that punch, how would you move? Would you move to the outside? And every once in a while you go, oh, shit, I moved to the wrong side. Mm-hmm. That's instructive. Yeah. And you're also doing it in the time of their kicks and punches. So you're doing it against someone of the caliber and speed of a professional fighter. So those are things you can do. You can film yourself or film one of your friends facing the camera and throwing random attacks with a pause in between. And you can play that in front of you and you can defend it as it's coming at you. And you can work on these things. So there's lots of things with modern technology you can do to create simulations. Look, it's never going to be the same as sparring with someone or whatever. But the problem that I think what COVID kind of showed a lot of people, it was like, especially in the martial arts world, You had people that immediately migrated to online training. We did online training here. And you had people who are like, no, you can't train my martial art online because my martial art is too real and too hardcore. And they withered.
Oh.
Okay? You know, or just their schools became decimated because now, look, would I prefer to teach you Bong Lap Da in person, molding your arms? 100%. Can I still do it in an online way where I can interact going towards the camera? You move out of the way here and I can look at correct your position. Yes, I can do that.
Yes.
And that is already going to make you better. And then when I do see that person in person, I can finally correct those movements there and they at least have the patterns. So it doesn't have to be the same. The mistake is it's not the same as the real thing. No one said it was. But your alternative when you say I cannot do anything online or anything virtual is you then do nothing.
Damn.
And that is not what you want to do either, right? So it's like your martial art is so hardcore, you can't do it online. Okay, fine. Your students are going to stay home. They're going to lose motivation. They're going to lose skill. And they're not even going to be doing their movements in the air, you know, pantomiming them and keeping the movement patterns like fresh. They're just going to lose it. So, you know, be careful of not doing something because it's not perfect. All right, that's what stopped so many people. Had I opened my school when I thought it was the perfect time or when I was ready, I still would not have opened my school to this day. Had I decided to have kids, and this is obviously a personal thing for different people, when I was ready to have kids, would still not have kids. I have two kids. I'm not ready to have kids. No one's ready to have kids. When you have kids, you get ready very fast,
very
right?
Fast.
So, you know, the same thing, like, you know, sometimes you just got to say, okay, let me do it. All right, like the way I study Cantonese or study other languages, is it perfect? Would I rather be there in an immersion course with an instructor who could teach me how to speak perfect Cuban Spanish every day? Yes. Do I have that? No. So what am I going to do? Not try to get better at it, right? So you have to do something.
Where I'm from, we don't say, let's just do it. We say, sometimes you just got to say, fuck it.
That's right. Or nothing to it but to do it.
Hey.
Yeah, all right. I prefer that one. That's the PG-13 version.
Yeah, that's right. All right, Dre, what's the next one?
All right.
Hey, Kung Fu Genius listeners. Are you a fan of Wing Chun Kung Fu? Well, if you listen to me, I assume you are. I got great news for KFG fans. Right now, you can get an all-access one-month free trial subscription to Wing Chun Illustrated Magazine. Yes, I said free. Go to WCINewsstand.com and register in the upper right-hand corner. Fill out your email and password and use the code KFGTRIAL to get your free trial to all the issues from 2011 to the current issue. That's right, all the issues, even the one with this cool guy on the cover. That's me for those of you listening to us on audio. My Kung Fu Genius column is also in all the new issues, as if you needed another reason to get this awesome magazine. Go get your free trial subscription today. For all that information, check out the description below. And now back to me.
Next up, we got these handles sometimes. They be getting me, man. Running Ewoks.
Running Ewoks.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Sounds like they're trafficking Ewoks.
Yeah, I know, right? All right, what do we got?
Okay, why do people still focus on styles instead of self-cultivation like Bruce Lee taught?
Okay, what, would you join a martial arts school that the title was self-cultivation? Join here. It sounds like you're joining a wacky cult.
It sounds like a cult.
It's total cult, right? I get it. All right, and this kind of harkens back to the very first question about the intrinsic aspects of martial arts versus the more base fighting side of learning martial arts, right? Most people, well, they're not really looking for that at first, all right? If you said, like, look, martial arts is all just about self-cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that could be true, but is anyone going to come to learn that? It literally sounds like it sounds like a cult, all right? We don't teach martial arts. We teach martial self-cultivation. I'm getting the F out of here.
Cultivation.
Right? The moment, yeah, the word cult is in there, all right? The moment I hear that, I'm going the other way. I think it's the responsibility of all martial arts instructors to at some point with their senior students start to show them how all martial arts essentially are all practical and all real martial arts, right? Not Rex Kwon Do or whatever, right? All essentially have the same ideas, or they're all trying to essentially solve the same problems. They do it in different ways. The whole kind of we are all going to the same mountaintop, but we go there on different paths. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your ability to control your ego and to control how you look at things, that is a huge influencer in terms of how good you're going to be in martial arts. If you cannot let go of your ego, you're going to have really hard time when you train with people who are bigger and stronger than you, and in reckoning that with, you know, making progress, right? So I think it's a natural progression for all high-level people in martial arts. And let us not forget that when Bruce Lee started to get super philosophical about his Jeet Kune Do, he had already been doing martial arts for 12 years at that point. So if you talk to Bruce Lee, I mean, yes, he talked about Taoist philosophy and all this kind of stuff, but like when he really gets deep into those writings about Jeet Kune Do and about freeing your mind, when he's read like later, Alan Watts and Krishnamurti or whatever, he's not a beginner. Mm-hmm. And so the problem with, and you have these kind of figures in many different pursuits. Krishnamurti, whom Bruce Lee followed, is really, I love reading Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti was that guy in his religion, because Krishnamurti was actually raised in a very religious upbringing. And I forget the name of the specific church he came from, but it was like a very regimented style of, I believe it was a form of Christianity or something, or some kind of world religion. I forget exactly what it was. And he was being groomed as the next world leader in this religion. And so he benefited from having a very traditional religious upbringing. And at some point was like, this is all BS. None of this is true. These are all illusions. There is truth. As he said, truth is a pathless land. And so you have to now stop trying to look for security and orthodoxy, and you have to start trying to answer the deeper questions, which are out of the realms of established institutions, whether it's religion or, in our case, martial arts. But Krishnamurti came to this realization after having benefited from very classic religious upbringing. Bruce Lee came from Wing Chun. His father practiced Tai Chi. He had learned some classical martial arts from his uncle Siu Hon San, and depending on who you ask, Fuk Yung taught him everything, all right? But he had a lot of classical martial arts training, and even if he was already starting to do things his own way, at some point he realized you cannot be bound by these particular styles and still, you know, find the truth, you know, that there's no such thing as an effective segment of a totality, and most martial arts are segments. And no matter how effective that segment is, it doesn't speak for the totality. So Bruce Lee came to that same Krishnamurti-esque realization, most likely because he read Krishnamurti, having benefited from classical martial arts upbringing to a certain degree, even though I wouldn't say Bruce had the most classical martial arts upbringing. Other martial artists who learned their martial arts style in a very, you know, standard and classical way, many of them at some point will be like, well, it doesn't have to be that way. We can blend these things, or we can open up our minds or whatever. That is the classic route of someone who goes really deep into something. Like I said before, the lawyer, the doctor of law, can at some point come to an understanding to look at law as a euphemism for human interaction. And now suddenly that person's lifelong body of studying law has now transcended into a philosophy of how humans interact. All right. So it's not because of martial arts, but the person who has gone really deep into their pursuit and then suddenly comes to this overwhelming realization that everything they've been doing in their pursuit is essentially just a metaphor for how the world is. And then they come to this and they realize the truth is a pathless land, or we cannot be bound by styles, or all martial arts, all martial arts systems are just a crystallization of what was once free and now it's not free anymore. Whatever those set pieces are that these guys say.
Yeah.
That realization comes best through actual deep martial arts training. And so many people read the philosophy of Bruce Lee having not even dipped their balls into an introductory class of martial arts. And suddenly they're like, oh, yeah, I totally get it. And they think, well, you just blend the styles and just open. It's just about developing yourself or whatever. And a beginner who has not gone through the path can give lip service to those nice sounding things, but they will never actually really understand it. My view now, being a orthodox or whatever Wing Chun practitioner over all the years, you know from our personal conversations, I have a super open view of martial arts in general. I will talk very openly about, oh, I like how this karate guy moves, or hey, look at, you know, Maxivo, look at how he does this, this is totally awesome, or hey, look at this kickboxer, or look how this MMA guy moves, or whatever. I look at martial arts in a very open way and say, wow, this guy's really good. It doesn't matter, you know, so many people who do Wing Chun cannot say a nice thing about someone who does not do Wing Chun, and they can barely say something nice about someone from another Wing Chun lineage, let alone another martial arts style. For me, I'm like, well, this Wing Chun guy is really good. Even someone not from my lineage, I like what that guy does. I like what this person is doing here. Doesn't matter to me what style. I have a very open mind about martial arts and martial arts as a phenomenon. I'm not like, well, if it's not Wing Chun and not WT Wing Chun, it's crap. For me, those are the low-level, mid-tier guys who still feel that way. They don't have a lot of exposure to anything outside of the very small box they created for themselves. For me, I love all this stuff. It doesn't make me any less of a Wing Chun person, but it just means that I'm not like, I don't have these blinders on, right? But there are people that read this stuff online and they think that they're already there. They think that they have the shortcut to getting there, all right? And so those are usually the people that think the path to learning martial arts is just to mix a bunch of shit. And then, you know, because truth is a pathless land, right? Krishnamurti said that's all going to mix like, you know, boxing and this thing and this thing. And hopefully put it together like going to a buffet and eating one of everything and hoping not to get indigestion. You got to
find the shortest shortcut.
Yeah. And so that same philosophy out of the mouth of someone who has actually not been through real hard training is vapid and empty. All right. It only means something to me from someone who's actually been through that shit. OK, so I think that you cannot shortcut the experience. And then the second and last point to that is like one. So you cannot shortcut it. You got to get to that through actual introspection. But the other problem is people who come to that epiphany, there are no martial arts styles. It is just human interaction. It's just, you know, like Bruce Lee said, there is no Chinese way, or it might be a Japanese approach or a Chinese approach, but we're all just humans with two legs and two arms. It's all just one. And like you kind of break away, like your mushroom psychedelic, you know, breakthrough, right? Okay. It's all just one. It's not that all these divisions are bullshit. This is not real. This is just created by people. None of this is real. Many times, those people are the worst effing teacher for anyone else, all right? Because the problem is you come to me and you want to learn if someone grabs me, how do I defend it? If someone tries to kick me, how do I do it? And I need to give you some examples. I need to give you some methods. I need to give you, to a certain degree, some type of style or way of dealing with this, whether it's a grappling way of doing it or a striking way of doing it. I cannot go, well, when someone gives you a kick, it's not really the kick. The leg is just an instrument of their own internal anger. And you need to learn how to not let them apply this instrument of anger against you. And so there are many methods to defend a kick. You could let it go by. You could close the gap. You could block it. You could pass it. You could kick the person. You could catch it and sweep their leg. Do you understand? And then I walk away into the back room and you are more confused than the day before you signed up for martial arts training. All right. And so the problem is the people with that overwhelmingly open, super philosophical, pseudo hippie way of looking at martial arts, you need to keep them the F away from beginning students because they're just going to rot their brains and make them more confused. The more junior someone is, the more you're like, okay, I'm going to teach you this approach. Our approach is Wing Chun. You got to close the gap. You got to do this. And over time, they get better and better and better and better. And as they have more skills and experience, you could say, oh, look, here's another way you can look at it. Here's another thing you can do. If that one doesn't work, you can go like this. Those things have to, you cannot rush that. So the self-cultivation thing for me is trying to force feed someone the final product who hasn't even taken the first step yet. And that's also not the right way to do it. Damn. All right, next question.
I can't wait to come to this epiphany in life.
Yeah.
Man. Another 80 years, maybe. All right, next up we got...
He forgot how old he was.
Eddie Tours, the Lan. Whatever happened to Mike Stone? Did he ever talk about Bruce?
So I'm maybe not the best person to answer that question. So, Mike Stone, he had trained a little bit with Bruce Lee. He was a competitive karate practitioner. He's got a photo with Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris. And Bruce Lee, at least according to John Little, he said Bruce Lee thought, you know, Mike Stone was quite good. And Mike Stone was very skillful. He has said a couple things here and there. I know from some JKD people who met Mike Stone said, you know, he's also one of these guys that, you know, maybe say, yeah, well, really, I could have taken Bruce if I wanted to or whatever. But then he's also said the opposite, right? So I don't believe you just need to listen to someone's solitary comments taken in isolation. I think you should look at the body of someone's comments over a period of time to get an idea, because something that someone said one time could be taken a little bit out of context. You need to like say, okay, in the 48 years since Bruce Lee died, what is the sum aggregate of what Mike Stone has said about Bruce Lee? Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, I think most of it has been positive, but this question wasn't really so much about that. Mike Stone, you know, famously was dating Priscilla Presley. So essentially, Priscilla Presley, and I talked about this on another episode.
Yeah.
Priscilla Presley basically left Elvis when, you know, Elvis was really starting to go off the rails and started dating Mike Stone. So you imagine, she goes from the king of rock and roll to some broke ass karate instructor, right? And, you know, Mike Stone, I believe, is from Hawaii, very good looking, kind of dark skin, dark features, very, at that time, very good looking dude.
Yeah.
You know, Elvis wasn't having it, right? And so I read, and I think I talked about this before. I read a book, yeah, two karate dudes, Elvis and then Mike Stone, right? Although I think there's probably a bit of a difference in skill between Mike Stone and Elvis, right?
You mean in performing or in karate?
Oh, okay. Especially when we're talking about 70s Elvis, all right? Where Elvis probably had a harder time lifting his leg, because when he would look down at his leg, he would see four of them instead of just one. You know, can I not imagine what Elvis was seeing at that point in his life? So according to the, you know, his little Memphis Mafia, his entourage, they wrote a book, I think, in the 70s. One of them wrote it was called Elvis, What Happened? And I read that one. Maybe 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And according to that, Elvis, you know, wanted to put out a hit on Mike Stone because he just could not fathom the fact that Priscilla would leave him, freaking Elvis Presley, you know, top of the food chain, for a karate instructor. And so he had talked to his Memphis Mafia about, like, you know, take out this Mike Stone. Mike Stone was not a Kenpo karate guy. I don't think he was from the Ed Parker camp. I could be wrong on that. So it wasn't, because I think if he was one of the Ed Parker guys, it would have been a little bit different, because Elvis was an Ed Parker guy, right?
Yeah.
He just would have told Ed Parker to kill him, and Ed Parker would have done it. Why'd you kill him? Well, Elvis asked me, what are you going to do, right? It's Elvis, right? There was it. But, you know, obviously he didn't follow through on that. I think I'm actually friends with Mike Stone on Facebook. He's done, you know, he tried to do some ninja movies in the 80s. He was supposed to star in Enter the Ninja, but I think he had some disagreements with the producer. So he ended up just doing the stunts and stuff. So, yeah, Mike Stone, like, he tried to have a little bit of a movie career, but didn't really, you know, didn't.
Wow.
Yeah. And like I'd mentioned the story before, you know, that Priscilla was with Mike Stone for a while, and then she broke up with Mike Stone, and then
became your aunt or something.
And then she didn't become my aunt.
In the
80s or 90s, my godmother, South African woman, looked a little bit like Brigitte Nielsen. Yeah. And the weird thing is, actually, her last name was Nielsen, too. Joanne, and she married this guy Marco Garibaldi from Brazil, who was a huckster and a scam artist, who was just basically pretending. And by the way, if you're watching this, Marco, fuck you. And so he was a huckster and a scam artist, and he was trying to be a producer. And I think Marco Garibaldi's not even his real name. He wanted to sound more Italian, but he's from Brazil. And so he's basically a scam artist. And my godmother had a lot of connections in Hollywood. And he, you know, he was younger, and he clearly married her for, like, some of the connections. And my godmother introduced Marco to Priscilla Presley. Priscilla was one of my godmother's friends, or they knew each other. And Marco ran off with Priscilla. And so, and it was interesting, when I was younger, I remember when my godmother, my late godmother, was with Marco, like, my mom hated that guy. And like, because I remember as a kid hearing about it, you know, like, I don't know about this guy. He seems like a huckster or whatever. Turns out my mom was right. He is a huckster. I think he had a couple kids with Priscilla, but they never married. And but they have since broken up. But yeah, he's a piece of shit. Anyway, that's nothing to do with Mike Stone. But any chance to say Marco Garibaldi's a piece of shit?
Nah, but
I'll go for it.
It's making me think of the memes you got. Got my man filming with Priscilla Presley in the back. Body, yaddy, 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 yaddy. You see Priscilla twerking.
Oh, no. Instagram you reels.
You can't make a wife out of a hoe.
You can't. Sorry, Elvis. We should have.
Yeah.
Should have told you. Elvis. Someone should have told Elvis.
Yeah, someone should have told Elvis.
Damn.
Yeah.
All right. So next up, we got Dryzen. And
seriously, though?
What?
Really?
Yeah, he's right here.
You know, there's some people.
He's next.
You know what? There's some people in the comments that say we should ban Dryzen from the channel. And wow. I think some of them are serious, though.
Yeah.
But it's our podcast, so we'll let it. All right, go ahead.
I think I kind of agree with them.
Yeah, maybe.
I agree, too. Yeah. He's a little outrageous.
He's a little outrageous. And his questions are long.
Yeah, well.
All right, let's go.
I mean, I got to read all this.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah, you gotta read all of this.
All right, let's go.
Imagine what I'm going through.
Yeah, I can just imagine what you're going through making this shit up.
If you saw what was on the screen right now, you'll cry.
Yeah, it's yada, yada, yada.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. I just saw the secret to it.
I was going to say, I expected it to be pornography.
Yeah.
OnlyFans.
Pornography. All right, let's go.
Dryzen's up. And he's asking a hypothetical.
Shocker.
And he says, all right, Sifu. Sifu Alex, love the podcast. You're the shit.
Wow, he's trying to butter you up a little bit now.
Butter me up.
You're the shit. That Dre guy can suck a fat.
What? Oh, my God.
Yo.
Maybe we're going to have to ban him at some point.
I don't,
yeah, it's getting a bit cheeky. Right?
I'm just reading this for the first time. I'm tight right now.
Yeah, I know. I know. You said it two times.
The British guy
is
awesome, though.
Oh.
Oh.
All right.
Okay.
He's clearly never met the British guy.
I haven't read this shit.
Igor.
I have one question, though. You picked the questions. But you say you haven't read this.
I kind of glanced through it, but I didn't see that part.
He sounds like Birdie. He's got an answer for everything. All right, let's go. Let's go.
So, anyway, you're at dim sum with your family.
Okay.
And you're dipping in some dim sum. Boom, boom, boom. Having a great time.
Dipping in some dim sum.
Yeah.
Really, he's never actually had dim sum before.
This dim sum is all that in dim sum.
Dim sum and den sum.
And you bite into some dim sum, and all of a sudden you're starting to get faded and starting to black out. You see the blackness, and then all of a sudden you collapse in your chair. Boom, wow, out the chair. Boom, and you come to. And you come to, and you open your eyes, and you see a bunch of guys above you. They help you up into your chair. You're still a dim sum, but not with your family. You're with Grandmaster Yip Man and Lung Ting, and a bunch of other students from the association.
All right.
But it's like normal. They don't.
They don't say anything about me.
No,
I look Chinese in their eyes or what? Because a white dude at dim sum in 72,
you're just a guaylo at the table.
That would be like a freak show.
Yeah. Well, yeah. They don't acknowledge that you're a guaylo.
Okay, right.
So you just roll with it.
I just roll with it. Yeah. Yeah, makes sense.
All right. And then Lung Ting turns and he says, "Yo, man."
Yo, man. Clearly, this person's never met Lung Ting before. He said, "Yo, man."
Yo, man.
Those words in that order have never come out of his mouth.
Right.
To this day.
He says, yo, my guy, after dim sum, we got to finish what we were talking about. We got to finish this whole starting my school thing.
Okay. Him starting his school.
Yes.
Oh, so he's like starting his, got it. Okay.
Young Lung Ting.
Got it. Right. Okay. Got it. But he has not. All right. So between 1969 and 1970, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe 71. He was basically teaching at the Wing Chun Athletic Association for Gramercy Yipman. And then he secured the old premises of the Wing Chun Athletic Association, which is 440 Nathan Road, because they had moved the Wing Chun Athletic Association to a little further up in Mongkok, right? The border of Mongkok and Prince Edward.
Right.
All right. And then so Sifu Leung Ting took the old premises of the VTAA, and that is still the school to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And then so at the opening of his gym, Sifu Leung Ting, Gramercy Yipman came as like a guest of honor. We see the photos where the Tang Sang was there and they have the martini and all that kind of stuff. And so that was basically the beginning of him.
I think that's the ceremony you fell out and woke up. Yeah,
that wasn't dim sum though. That was actually at the IWTA gym.
Oh, my bad, yeah.
That was at the opening there, right?
All right.
Wow. Yeah.
Okay.
So
Hashtag fail.
Yeah, well, no, that'd be very interesting. I mean, for me, that period of Sifu Leung Ting's career is the most interesting to me because I think the worst thing that happened, now, of course, I benefited from Sifu Leung Ting's success because his schools went all over the world and in Germany and you had the Trainer Academy or whatever. But I think one of the worst things that happened to Sifu Leung Ting was that he was so successful. Because when you look at him in the 60s and in the 70s, he was such a hard worker. You know, he was writing books and he had his own magazine. He had a TV show in the mid 70s. He became a fight choreographer for Shaw Brothers. He was doing lots of demonstrations. He had students who were training fighters to go into the full contact contest. And I think, like, you know, although maybe he was not quite as polished as an instructor as he might have later become, but 1970s, Sifu Leung Ting, for me, like, that is the one you follow in terms of, you know, an example for someone who really, like, really loves this stuff and really promotes it with all of his heart, right? Because he had to deal with a lot of shit from some of the seniors and not, you know, being a little bit upset that he was maybe more successful than them. And
being a grand student.
And all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, they attacked him with the successor event, which was kind of which actually just gave him press and stuff. There was Sifu Leung Ting had a TV show called Real Kung Fu. And he also had an eponymous magazine, so it means in a magazine with the same name, Real Kung Fu. And so he said eponymous, and you looked at me, and I was like, okay, let me tell you what that means.
Hippopotamus magazine.
Eponymous magazine. So he had
what?
So he had Real Kung Fu magazine, and he had Real Kung Fu TV show. I think it was on RTV, Rediffusion Television. And basically, it was kind of a competition for New Martial Hero magazine. And those are great. I have maybe about 15 issues of the Real Kung Fu magazine from the mid-70s.
Mm.
And they're really great because it would always feature like a sifu of whatever style on the cover. And it would have like a very in-depth article. And that sifu would maybe show some of their specialties and techniques. And then, of course, because Sifu Leung Ting published a magazine, he would have ads for his own Wing Chun schools in there as well. And but still, I found those, they were like very informative. Like, he wasn't just writing a puff piece magazine. He would, like, you know, he would have this master of this Hong Kun style go there and really explain what their style was about and how it worked and show it. And that, to a certain degree, at least in my opinion, is how Sifu Leung Ting became so knowledgeable about some of the other martial arts styles. Because a lot of people who never met Sifu Leung Ting, they might see some stuff online or whatever, and you get kind of a weird impression. But if you spend time with him, I mean, he knows so much about Chinese martial arts. Like, you ask him about, like, this obscure style, and he'll tell you the history and how this actually got changed when it went to here. And they use these movements, which are similar to Wing Chun, because that guy came from here. And he'll put this stuff together, and you can, like, just talk to him about this stuff, like, just endlessly. So for me, as, like, a budding kung fu geek, this was great. And because I had read a bunch of his magazines, I had, like, a lot of stuff I could talk to him about, like, in those things right there, right? And then he had a TV show as well, and it was basically a TV version of the magazine where he'd have different martial art masters maybe feature a different one every time. And when they made an announcement that his TV show was going to be on there, there was an a newspaper that was owned by a rival company that rivaled the RTV company. So I don't know which newspaper that was. Mm. But they were not too happy about Leung Ting getting this TV show or whatever. So they printed an article, and the headline was made inflammatory on purpose. And they said that Wing Chun Pai is the style, Jeongmunyan, which means the successor. All right, the successor of the Wing Chun style, meaning the guy who succeeds it after Yip Man, Leung Ting, has a TV show on RTV. And Leung Ting, and look, people say shit about, like, if he calls himself Grandmaster, all this kind of stuff. Look, I've spent time with him. I've read his books. I even have the Chinese version of his books, okay?
Okay.
He never, ever, ever once claimed that he was the head of the entire Wing Chun style. Not in private, not in any of his publications. This whole thing about him claiming himself to be the head of the whole Wing Chun style, which, by the way, if you've seen the cast of characters of the whole Wing Chun style post Yip Man's death, you would not want to be the head of that group, all right? Let all of them have their own styles and do their own thing. No one wants to be the collective head of a bunch of people who literally cannot get along for more than 5 minutes, all right? Let everyone do their own thing, right?
Bunch of nifkas.
But yeah, but the whole thing about Leung Ting is like, oh, Leung Ting once said he was the head. Did not. It was actually a headline in a newspaper that rivaled the company that published his magazine and TV show. So it was done to be and what did his Wing Chun seniors do? Oh my God, he claimed himself. He did not. Mm. And if you read the article, in the article, he never says it. It's literally the headline, all right? And so they, like, these Wing Chun got Leung Seung and all these guys, they had to have this big meeting, and they had to go on there and have a conference, and say, Leung Ting is not the head. And you can imagine, wow. Like, look, Siva Leung Ting has definitely, pardon my French, stepped on his dick a number of times in ways that are his fault, all right? He's had some PR stumbles, and he's done some things, and he's had some very public missteps that are 100% his fault. And I'm not an apologist for him on those things, okay?
Okay.
Because even when he had his very controversial court case with a girlfriend that he had supposedly hit or whatever, people don't realize this, but he was too cheap to hire a lawyer to do that. That's why he lost the first case.
Himself.
And then he only won on an appeal later when he actually decided to get a lawyer.
Okay.
He was going to write a statement about that. This was in 2009. And the statement he was going to write was batshit crazy. He wrote it himself.
Mm.
We were like, there is absolutely no way you can put this statement out there after you've been found guilty of this thing or whatever, right? So you know who wrote the actual statement that went on his website at leungting.com? This effing guy with my training partner, Hao. All right? We wrote it. And then they said that they had Sifu Cheng sign it as if Sifu Cheng wrote it. We were the ones that wrote it. So you have this guy who's like the head of this martial arts thing or whatever, doesn't even bother to get a PR person or a proper lawyer to write something. You have chuckleheads like me going like, no, this shit is way off base. We need to write it in proper English and get that thing out there, right? So he has the appearance of being like this, having this big association. Meanwhile, like, you literally have idiots like me writing legal letters so that he doesn't look like even more of a jerk when this stuff comes out, right? So anyway, but the whole thing about him ever claiming that he was the head of the Wing Chun style came from an inflammatory headline from a rival newspaper. He literally never said that, not privately, not publicly, not ever. All right. And there's a difference between saying you are the headmaster of your own school, which even at that time, I don't think he was saying, which is usually Zhongzi, like the head man of your own school or style, and Jeongmunyan, which is like the successor, the leader of the entire style. Right. You could be the headmaster of your Wing Chun school. Doesn't mean you are the headmaster of all of Wing Chun. So the term grandmaster, as it gets translated to English, there are two terms in Chinese that if you put these in a word a Cantonese dictionary, they would both translate to grandmaster in English. But there are literally two words for it. One is the successor and undisputed head of a martial arts school, of which we don't have these anymore. Every style of Chinese martial arts is now so disseminated that you do not have one standard head of the Eagle Claw style or of Wing Chun or of any style. and also Japanese martial arts, Okinawan martial arts, you have multiple heads of it, right?
Multiple heads.
So, so he got that kind of stuff there. So if we come back to this Dreisen question, okay, I would warn him about some of these things. I would warn him about a lot of his public missteps that would happen later. I would warn him about certain people. Mm. And because Siva Leung Ting is surrounded by a bunch of enabling yes men, mm-hmm. all right? And it hasn't helped him. And so I wouldn't tell him what to do in terms of, I would tell him, look, these are the people you want to follow. These are the missteps you want to avoid. And these are the people that you want to run screaming from the moment they enter your life.
Wow. Wow.
Got one more?
And questions are
terrible.
We got one from Candyman Tickle.
Candyman Tickle.
Will Viagra keep your woo up?
Will Viagra keep your woo up? That seems like an interesting experiment. You want to try?
Sure.
Try it and let us know.
Yeah, try and let us know. Oh, let's maybe ask one more question. Then we have to end it on that one.
I mean, you know, keep it up.
All right, next up we got Trust Obey 1016.
All right.
Did Bruce take those pics to piss off Raymond Chow? And I believe he's referring to the pic with Sammo Hung in the forefront.
You're talking about the ones where he's in the traditional costume.
Yes.
Where Bruce is wearing like the... Yes. Because Bruce never...
He kind of got his head down looking at something. Yeah. This pic right here.
Okay. No.
Or right here.
You're talking about the one with Sammo?
Yes.
Okay.
And Sammo looked like he's taking a selfie.
So, yeah.
Selfie Sammo.
Yeah, with his iPhone 00.1, right? Okay. That photo was taken at Golden Harvest. That wasn't to piss off Raymond Chow. That's a Golden Harvest photo.
No.
Yes. So there are photo shoots of Bruce Lee wearing the traditional, like he's wearing very traditional Chinese style period piece garments, right? Because, right. You know, if we look at Bruce Lee's films, the only one that's kind of a period piece, but not really, is Fists of Fury. But that's supposed to be in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. You know, so Big Boss was kind of like in modern day, but in Thailand, right? Fist of Fury is supposed to be, I think, in the 20s or 30s, maybe. Way of the Dragon is in modern 70s Italy, and you know, he comes from Hong Kong, right? And then Enter the Dragon is obviously supposed to be in the modern times. And Game of Death is presumably, judging by his sneakers, also in the modern times, right? So Fist of Fury is the only kind of period piece that he did, where he wears the Chinese-style Tong Chong. Although he also wore it in Way of the Dragon. But that was still the 20th century. So he had never done like a Qing Dynasty period piece or like, you know, the Tang Dynasty, you know, old style ones, right? And the question was always like, how would Bruce Lee have done in one of those more kind of period-esque kind of movies? And so he did a bunch of test shots where he had like the sword and the blood and all that kind of stuff. And he did it for Golden Harvest. This is a really good question for Steve Kerridge, because I don't know which photo shoot came first, the one for Golden Harvest right. or the one for Shaw Brothers, because Bruce was famously having some, you know, public disputes with Raymond Chow regarding money. He felt that Raymond Chow was kind of slow-boating him, especially with the returns on Way of the Dragon. And Run Run Shaw was openly courting Bruce to come over, right? Because Bruce first went to Shaw Brothers when he first came to Hong Kong and was like, hey, I'm here. What are you going to give me? And, Run Run Shaw basically put a... Because Bruce Lee was not yet Bruce Lee at that point, right? And he basically shoved a standard contract in front of Bruce Lee's face. And Bruce looked at that and was like, I'm not going to do this. And then eventually, you know, went to Raymond Chow, who now had his own studio and was a little bit more willing to give Bruce a little bit more what he wanted, although the deal was not great. It was like $15,000 for the first two movies. And then for the third movie, they renegotiated and created Concord Productions. And then he was in a co-production kind of thing with Raymond Chow, but it still felt that he was being slow-boated on the money
right
and stuff,
now.
Right? Yeah. It wasn't a great deal, though. And so Bruce was like kind of complaining a lot about the money and stuff. And then Run Run Shaw realized after Bruce had made those first couple movies that he kind of made a mistake not signing Bruce Lee. In fact, I recall reading an article about Run Run Shaw, who, you know, he died. He was like 100 and something years old when he died. He died.
Wow.
He died a few years ago. I mean, he lived very well. The supposedly the secret to his longevity is that he had a pint of breast milk every morning. so they would have a wet nurse literally provide like a pint of breast milk he would drink every morning, and he said that that had something to do with his longevity. Right?
Pure Cambodian.
I have no idea. You mean like P. Diddy, right?
What?
Yeah, so anyway, yeah. So I'm not mucking around with that. But anyway, he lived like well into his hundreds. I think maybe 104, 103. I don't remember his exact age.
Damn, son.
And he did really well when he closed up Shaw Brothers Studios. He still had TVB, so he was basically, he had an entertainment empire in Hong Kong. So even when he stopped making those movies, it became full-time TVB and TV dramas and stuff like that. And TVB is kind of like BBC in Hong Kong, but he's like basically controls most of like what's on TV there. So Run Run Shaw was always the top of the food chain. And, you know, I think they interviewed him towards the end of his life and asked him if he had ever had any regrets, which is, you know, when someone who's lived such a long life and is a multi-millionaire, you go, have you ever had any regrets? No, I think I did pretty good. But he said that he regretted not seeing what Bruce Lee was when he came to him and offering him such a low contract. Because purportedly Linda Lee later, when Bruce became a big star, Run Run Shaw sent a check over to Bruce. And so I believe I heard that Linda still has this check. Maybe she sold it. Mm. But it was a check written to Bruce Lee, signed by Run Run Shaw, and it was blank. And so basically he was saying, like, come over here and name your price. He was ready. Wow. He was ready to, because you also have to realize that there's some personal shit between Run Run Shaw and Raymond Chow. Mm-hmm. Because Raymond Chow used to be an employee of Run Run Shaw. And he used to be basically like the PR guy. And then later he started to become more involved in the movie process and then created Golden Harvest Studios as a subsidiary originally of Shaw Brothers. And what Raymond Chow was doing is he was seeing when those actors' contracts were running up and he was starting to poach them. And Raymond, you know, although he later became a very fine, distinguished gentleman himself, he basically backstabbed Run Run Shaw. Now we could say, well, if he had not done that, maybe we would not have found Bruce Lee. Things turn out the way they do. So these are non-overlapping things, yeah, but right. Still, he pretty much backstabbed Run Run Shaw. So when suddenly Run Run Shaw's ex-employee had this huge star that he kind of took from under his nose, Run Run, if anything, just wanted to get him back just for pure revenge. Mm. But obviously knowing he could make money with Bruce Lee, so he was really ready, willing, and able to take Bruce Lee back. And Bruce did a photo shoot at Shaw's studios in the traditional Chinese-style clothing, Manchurian-style clothing, all that kind of stuff. And so I don't know if Bruce had done a similar photo shoot in Golden Harvest before the Shaw Brothers one or okay. after. But these are two separate photo shoots. So when people see Bruce in the studio with that stuff on, a lot of people go like, oh, that's the Shaw Brothers one, but there's also a Golden Harvest one. And the one where you see Sammo Hung there, that was obviously the one at Golden Harvest because Sammo Hung was also on the Golden Harvest roster. So
he didn't go to Shaw and do that with Bruce?
No, Sammo pretty much just stayed with Golden Harvest. Later in the late 70s, he created his own film company. But most, like him and Jackie, were pretty loyal to Golden Harvest, with the exception of when Jackie was making some movies with Lo Wei and stuff like that, until they did their own thing, until they were big enough to do their own thing. That actually, a lot of those guys did not cross over. Most of the people who did Shaw films were pretty loyal to Shaw's. And most of the people who did Golden Harvest films, they were kind of loyal to those guys there. Yun Hua, the guy who is Bruce Lee's stunt double, who plays, you know, the husband in Kung Fu Hustle, right? And he's also in Shang-Chi.
Yeah.
He would do movies for Shaw Brothers, and he would occasionally, well, he would do movies for Golden Harvest, and every once in a while you'll see him as a baddie in a Shaw Brothers movie because he wasn't as high profile. He was more a background stunt guy. Lam Ching Ying, mostly Golden Harvest, but he popped up a couple times in some Shaw films.
Oh,
so the lower tier guys sometimes would go back and forth a little bit, but the moment that they had like a certain status, usually they wouldn't cross over because they were too high profile, so... Anyway, that's all I got to say about that. All right, Kung Fu Genius fans, I hope you liked that episode. Of course, as always, if you have questions for me to answer, don't forget to write those in the comments below. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the Kung Fu Genius and hit that bell for notifications. And I'll see you guys next time. Word is-
is, I'm a kung fu genius. Technique speaks for me, not lineage. Forget Jet Li, cause I'm the one. Many call me Sifu, but to you I'm Seagung. And I produce masters, you surpassed us. Your kung fu stiffer than corpse and caskets. City Wing Chun is the house I built. Violate the gate and your blood gets spilt. Alex Richter, always the victor.
Keep it up, let's keep it going. Chris, what are your opinions on the use of hooks and uppercuts in Wing Chun, and how do they differ from boxing, or differ in use from boxing? They exist in the system, but seem so underutilized.
We answered this question on a previous AMA.
I knew it. I was looking through the scroll and I couldn't find it. And I was like, shit.
We did that one already.
All right. Next up. I love that. I love how you remember.
Yeah.
I kind of remembered. I know.
Belated. But
that's why I'm the KFG
important.
And you're the TFG.
Of course, that fucking guy.
Wow, with the F-bombs.
That's okay. We got Andrew now.
He can fix those F-bombs. And I believe he's referring to the pick with Sammo Hung in the forefront.
Did we do this one also?
No, but okay. We were talking about it earlier. The genius will be answering all sorts of hot nonsense from YouTube. Lots of gems, lots of hot shit. Fuck, man, I had it right here. I just had it.
All right, here we go. Another AMA in the
Okay, Puka. Another victory. They can't get with me. So pick a PC day, cause your history. I'm the imperial.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
All right, good. Although I gotta cut him off, otherwise he won't stop. Oh,